Okay, dammi attenzione a te. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
The interesting thing, I suppose, with Buddhism is it's like a science of the mind. So it's like looking into action, looking into cause and effect. And, you know, in different spiritual traditions, there's meditation. But in all the traditions, people who meditate a lot, they always say that, you know, in Buddhism, it's amazing the actual framework of the mind. The level that the Buddha described things in such detail is quite phenomenal. And so a lot of the teachings, it's like when you come to meditation, the Buddha might have a teaching on how to overcome thinking, or how to overcome restlessness or worry or doubt, or just the amount of teachings is huge. And they're all for a specific purpose. Like if you have a problem, you know, well, what's the cause of that problem? How do you overcome that problem? So it's like a cause and effect, cause and effect. And so at the basic level, the Buddha teaches us about karma. So it's like there is mother and father, there is ascetic and Brahman, so meaning, you know, people who live off the gifts of others. The heavenly realms exist, the hell realms exist. But in Buddhism, it's not that, these things are eternal states. The problem is that When you die, you accumulate a karma, then you get reborn. And that might sound great, you know, maybe I'm some famous artist or something in the next life. But what about a million lives? What about a billion lives? What about a trillion lives? Like, so in Buddhism, the suffering is hard to see if you have an nihilistic view that, you know, it's just one life. But when you start to look that, you know, to become a person who knows how to train the mind, it requires a teacher. It requires a training. So if you want to be a great artist, you go train under a great artist of your day. If you want to be a great bicycle maker, then you go under a great bicycle maker or whatever it is, you know. So the way that you learn that skill is by somebody who's perfected that art if you want to do it the best. And then not only just, you know, learn from them, but apply those teachings. And so it's a bit daunting, the amount of teachings that are in Buddhism. But the way the Buddha taught about it, but better than knowing 10,000 verses is, you know, to put one into practice. You know, so on a day where you're angry, well, be kind. You know, on a day where you're lazy, well, you know, put some effort in. You know, on a day where you know, you're greedy, well, you know, don't follow that desire. So it's like learning to become aware of our actions is something that we do have the ability to control. And there's this kind of common notion in Buddhism that, you know, just be in the present moment and don't do anything. But actually the Buddha was very scientific. He said, before you do an action, you should think about it. While you do an action, you should think about it. After you do an action, you should think about it. Meaning that until you're an enlightened being, like an awakened being, you know, you've got to learn what your actions are, what is good, what is bad, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, what produces good karma, what produces bad karma. So it's like a tapestry of knowledge to be learned. But, you know, we don't need a lot of information. We just need to be able to investigate our lives. So when we have difficulties, like I was mentioning the other night, there was a dog barking for 2 hours, you know, just when I was to go to bed. And so for about 20 minutes, I'm peaceful. And then my mind starts going, why is that dog barking? And I'm like, well, you know, that's what dogs do. You know, they think there's some trouble when they bark. And so I went through this about 4 times in the 2 hours. And by the end of it, I'm like, oh, that's a really good dog. He's really barking well. And I said, good dog. And then he was quiet. So it's like, sometimes it's not necessarily easy to go against, you know, the grain of our mind, because our mind, you know, naturally wants to complain, it naturally wants to produce problems, and it naturally wants to blame other people other than ourselves. But the idea is, it's, you know, it's easy to point out somebody else's faults, but it's difficult to look at our own. So like, if we're ever going to point out somebody else's faults or something wrong, then we need to make sure that it's the right time, that we're coming from a place of metta, like, which is like kindness. And usually, if you just think of that to begin with, then 9 times out of 10, you won't be telling people off about anything. Because you find that usually that mind that wants to tell people off, it comes from a place of irritation. You know, so you can turn it back on yourself and say, well, now's not the time to do it, because clearly I don't have a wholesome mind. You know, if I was doing it for their welfare, then I would have a good mind at the moment. And that irritation tells me I don't have a good mind. And so, yeah, it's funny. And I don't know if I was a towel maker in a previous life, but one of my pet hates used to be, like, people leaving wet towels. And so I don't know how many times since I've been a monk, you know, I've gone, I'm going to tell those monks off for leaving that wet towel there. I don't think I've ever actually told anybody off. So every time I've seen that it was actually my own defilements and stopped myself from saying anything. Because when you look at the petty things in life we get annoyed at, I mean, that actually happened. One day my mind was complaining about this towel this person left on the line. Because we have a rule as monks where you try and bring in cloth overnight to help protect it so it doesn't get damaged. So if you can. And So here's my mind going out, fault-finding somebody else, saying, you know, what a terrible person they are for leaving their towel on the line, and I'm going to tell them. But I caught myself and stopped myself from saying anything, as I always did. This is years ago now. And that night they died. You know, they had a heart attack and died. So imagine if the last thing I ever did was tell them, you're a bad person for leaving a towel on the line. And, you know, they were a good friend of mine. So the point is, like, you know, when you're in the world, you know, it's the politicians, it's your boss, it's your neighbor. You're always, you know, it's the other person who did that in the car, that, you know, they cut in front of you. It's always somebody else. But you go to a monastery and then you notice it's the other people in the monastery. There's a pattern here. You know, so we're always trying to, you know, vent our angers or our problems on other people. And so the trick is to use our experience to develop wisdom. Now, so you catch yourself, you see the patterns that we have, you just see the defilements, and then you're prepared for them. So it's like saving for the rainy day. So after you do a meditation sometimes, so you might sit for 15 minutes. When I started meditation, the goal was just to sit quietly for 15 minutes. And then I would kind of journal for a while. There was no meditation object. It was just be peaceful, be, you know, quiet. And because a lot of our problems in life come because we're restless. You know, we're always, we've got the television, we're driving the car, we're at work, we're at home, and we never have any peace. So by just starting by having a little bit of peace in our life, then we start to settle down. You know, we're not so kind of reactive to the world around us. And then once we have that peace, it's easier to start to see the tendencies of our mind. And so when I first went to the monastery, the way that I was taught was, you know, just see, like, which is the worst defilement that you have, you know, and then work on that for 6 months. Say, okay, well, this is my problem, you know, like when I first went to the monastery, I think I was lost, because obviously becoming celibate is a difficult thing. So what I did is start to learn the teachings of the Buddha on how to overcome lust. So, like, for example, for monks, if they're attracted to women, the Buddha would say, like, for me, you know, think of them as your mother or your sister or your daughter, or you know, you can contemplate the elements, or you know, there's many teachings the Buddha gave. But the thing is, if you were just to wait until the lust arose, and what chance would you have of developing it? So the idea is to overcome a defilement or a difficulty in your life. It's like saving for a rainy day. You know, if you just wait until your house burns down, you're like, oh, I don't need any insurance or any funds, and then you're going to be on the street. So the idea of saving for a rainy day means that you're preparing for the inevitable disaster that might happen. And so if we apply that to our mind, it means that if we're going to overcome a defilement, there's no point to waiting till we're, you know, boiling with anger before we try and think kind thoughts. I mean, so you can apply that training for the rainy day, meaning that you set out parts of your life to start to think about that. Like, what is it? Like, I remember even my teacher, Ajahn Brahm, I used to get really angry at him sometimes. He's wrong the way he's thinking. And then so I had this thing where I had to write, if I got angry at somebody, I had to write out a page of all the good things about them. You know, and once you get to, you know, I think I would write, you know, I did that with the towels, so I had the towel problem. So I'd be like, okay, so if I ever get angry about somebody with this towel thing, because I thought it was quite funny, but I had to come up with 10 good thoughts about that person. And by the time you got to, you know, 8 or something, your mind's totally given up. Like, because you're forcing yourself to think of all the good things you've ever remembered this person doing. You know, they could have just opened a door for you. They could have said good morning. You know, anything. And, or could just be things that they don't do. You know, they haven't chopped off your arm. And so you might have to be, you know, use your imagination. But you can come up with 10 things. And then by the time you come up with that, usually, because our mind's just like a little child. If you tell a child 10 reasons why they can't give any candy, by the time you get to 5, they've gone off, you know, they've totally lost interest. And so that's very much what our mind is like. And so with this teacher, Because that's like a bigger thing. That's like getting angry at your boss at work, you know. You're like, oh, they're wrong. They've done the wrong thing. And then so I had this thing where I had to write out this page. And, you know, it's really powerful because then, because you're doing this at a time where you're not in front of them and you're using your mind, that means that the more times you have those thoughts, then you, then the next time in the future, they're going to be at the back of your mind. They're going to be like an underlying tendency that you've developed. Because the mind, you know, what we think about, we become. So if we start to train ourselves to be ready for these difficult situations, it's like offensive training. We see the defilements in the distance and we prepare for that. And so like with the anger, I mean, I got to the point where people could shout in my face and I would tell them they're a nice person. So it's like, you know, it took a lot of training to get to that. In the begin with, I would get angry, you know, because certain people, it's like, you know, you can have respect and kindness for people, but some characters just don't get along. You know, you're just going to butt heads in whatever situation. But rather than seeing that as a bad thing, it's like, well, you know, the world is just full of different characters. So some characters don't get along, but it doesn't mean we can't have respect for one another, you know. And in Buddhism, anybody could be a Buddha in a future life. You know, it might take them a few million lives to become a Buddha, but it's a possibility. And so really, there's no reason for us to think bad thoughts about any being. And the Buddha's teaching on the simile of the sword, I always like, I mean, you know, paraphrasing, but it's like, you know, if somebody shouts offensive words at you, we think, well, at least they didn't throw sticks and stones at me. If they throw sticks and stones at you, well, you know, at least they didn't cut me. If they cut you, well, at least they didn't mutilate me. And if they mutilate you, well, their actions are their own, but, you know, I'll still respect them anyway. Meaning that there's never any reason for us to... The Buddha actually said, if we think a bad thought about another being, even in that scenario, then we're not doing his teaching. Meaning that we have the power to train our minds to be good in any scenario. You know, because that's just their action. I mean, they're going to reap the results of that action. But if they saw you, like, smiling at them as they were chopping your arms off, I'm sure that would deeply affect them the rest of their lives. and you know, it sounds like full-on, like we should be angry at that. But actually, it's like, in Buddhism, there's really no place for anger. It's not that, like, sometimes when you do things in a forceful way, you know, you're not angry because you're coming from, you know, a place of power and kindness. So some of the forest teachers, they may actually seem very stern. So there's a difference between sternness and anger because it's about where your heart comes from. So the analogy is, it's like if a child, if the nurse looking after a child, you know, doesn't pay attention for a moment and the child, like, eats a stick, and then the child's going to choke to death. So the nurse has to, like, you know, stick the fingers down the mouth, even if it's going to draw blood, to remove that stick. You know, so the nurse isn't drawing blood because, it, you know, she wants to draw blood, but she's doing it to save their life. And so that's the analogy. Sometimes with metta, when we do say things with metta, you know, we're not always going to please everybody. So it's not, as metta isn't about pleasing anybody. It's about talking in line with truth and talking at the right time. So, of course, sometimes we can accidentally talk at the wrong time. So, like, speech should be true, beneficial, and spoken at the right time, and, you know, come from a heart of kindness. And so that doesn't just happen overnight, you know. So, because in Buddhism, really, there's no place for lying, like, even as a joke, because the problem with lying is... Then that person won't trust you, you know. Even if it's just as a joke, you're like, if you do something in a funny way, but then the back of that person's mind, they're always going to be skeptical about what you're saying. So it's like truth is kind of like an absolute. But it doesn't mean you have to go around telling everybody the truth all the time. It just means that in the right place, you always tell the truth. There's no reason to ever lie about anything. If you don't want to say anything, you just say, I don't want to say it. You know, so that's still telling the truth. Because, you know, you feel you're going to offend them or it's not the right time or something. But because the problem with when we lie, that's like that can go into anything. So once you can lie about something, it's basically said that anything is possible. Any of your actions could go the wrong way. So the analogy is, if there's a jug with water in it, and that's your spiritual worth, if you lie, you're throwing all that water out. So then you've got to start again. You know, so truthfulness, which is satya in the ancient language, is very close to aditana, which is like resolution. So if you don't have strong truthfulness, it's very hard to have strong resolution. And if you don't have strong resolution, it's very hard to develop things like in a very meaningful way over a long term. And that's why you should never make resolutions that you can't do. So you shouldn't say, okay, I'm going to sit here tonight and become enlightened. Like, well, you know, I think when the Buddha did that, he'd done a lot of practice before he said that statement. He didn't just like decide, you know, he would do that randomly on his first week of a meditation retreat. So the idea is that truthfulness and determination, because they're a way of making good karma for ourselves. Because think about it, sometimes it's very difficult in a situation to tell the truth. You know, you have to go against a whole group of people to stand up for the truth in a difficult situation. But it builds character, so it's a very important thing. And then the more we're truthful and we can see the power of truth, then that leads into other areas of our lives. And then like when we come, so the purpose of meditation to begin with, quite often is just bringing that steadfast calm into our mind. So like when I was taught to meditate, it's like you set a period of time for your meditation, and then when the meditation's over, then that's it. So then you go back to doing what you're normally doing. And then so you train the mind that even if you're having, you know, bliss and peace and whatever, and when your meditation's over, you know, you turn your meditation off and then you go do your other chores. And then so at least you build a pattern of how to meditate. And then over time, you know, when you have, once you have a skill in meditation, then if you want to meditate for longer periods, you know, and say, okay, well, you know, just let the meditation go for a few hours, you can. But that way it turns into a skill. And because when you meditate, you know, like some people, you know, you might experience bright lights or lots of joy and happiness. And the problem is you can take that as the end goal. So then you're meditating to get those states, rather than the meditation is just a way to stabilize the mind, to bring peace into mind, so then we can develop wisdom, so then we can develop mindfulness. Because actually to become enlightened, it's like, you know, the analogy is like in the old days, to be the first son in a family, the first son would be the one who wake up the earliest and went to bed the latest and helped the family the most. You know, they really kind of dedicated themselves to helping the family. Or to be a village headman. I mean, you had to know everything that was going on in the village and everybody had to like you and you really had to put into it. Or to be a king, you know, to look after a kingdom. You had to kind of, or a kingdom where everybody in your kingdom loved you. You know, you had to be a really good person and put 100% in. And then so that idea of becoming enlightened is like, it's a skill. And so to becoming the best person in our fields of life requires, you know, like a commitment to excellence. So even if it's a commitment to excellence in washing the dishes, commitment to excellence in cleaning the toilets, you know, like whatever it is, like we don't have to see anything in our life as, you know, a meaningless chore, because it's an opportunity for us to develop mindfulness. It's an opportunity for us to be present. So that's why in the Thai tradition, usually they have like a mantra, like a Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, or in West, like peaceful or something. And the idea of having a mantra is useful because when we're developing mindfulness throughout the day, you know, most of our problems come from our mind just restlessly thinking. You know, it's just a monkey running through the forest doing whatever it wants. And so when you have your formal meditation practice, that's a time to develop some peace in your meditation practice. But then through the day, it's difficult to develop mindfulness. So mindfulness is where we're present and where we're aware of a meditation object or a mindfulness object. And usually, so in the Thai forest, they just have a word, because you can say it with the breath or you can just repeat it in your mind. And the good thing about that is you know when you're not doing it. So by proxy, if you're thinking other thoughts, so obviously there's times and tasks where you need to use your brain, but you know, most of the things that we do in the day, we don't actually require any kind of engagement. You know, we're just doing tasks. And so what this does is give you a way to know that you're being mindful. You know, it's difficult to get going, and you know, it might take a few days of hard work. But in other traditions, even like Gandhi, you know, he used a meditation object all day long. Like, it's a known way to train the mind. And why that's good is because then you're developing mindfulness through the day. And then, because a lot of our problems come from our mind thinking random thoughts and then getting involved with the moods of those thoughts and creating problems for ourselves. So if we can cut out some of the proliferation, and even if it's just like a minute an hour to begin with, like every hour for 1 minute, you're going to do this activity. You know, that still requires lots of effort to remember to do that every hour. And even doing it 1 minute every hour and your 15 minutes of meditation a day would, you know, be a huge improvement to your awareness of your mind and your life. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be, you don't have to be doing this for 15 hours a day on your first go or anything. You know, that might be take some lifetimes for some people. But the idea is that training the mind is a difficult thing. So this analogy of, you know, saving for a rainy day is good because it means you've got to look at what the problems are in the future if we don't do this. You know, what's our life going to be in 20 years if we don't develop some peace, if we don't develop some wisdom? You know, what kind of life, what kind of person do we want to be? What values do we want to stand for? You know, and developing our mind, our heart, is a great way of engaging more in life, being a better person. And then to look at, you know, our areas of life that we're doing things in a meaningful way. Like I always liked Martin Luther King when he said, you know, if you're a street sweeper, then be the best damn street sweeper there's ever been. You know, like, it doesn't have to matter what your job is. It's like you can make anything meaningful, you know, but it doesn't mean you can't aspire for something better. And the perfect example that comes to mind is one of the past lives of the Buddha. He was a wheel cart maker, so the wheels. And this king wanted him to make some wheels for a royal chariot. And it took 6 months to make one wheel and then 6 weeks to make the other one because he had a deadline. And then the king said, you know, what's the deal? You spent 6 months on one and 6 weeks on the other. And then he rolled the one that took 6 weeks, it rolls along, and it fell over. And then he rolled the one that took 6 months to make, and it rolled, and it stayed perfectly on its rim. It was like totally perfect. And you know, so a Buddha is a being who's perfected themselves through countless lifetimes. So why they're, you know, when we come to the teachings of the Buddha, we have access to teachings of a being who perfected themselves. And so it doesn't mean that we need to be a Buddha or we need to become enlightened. A lot of people would just come to the Buddha and say, oh, you know, how do I be a good king? Or how do I be a good parent? Or, you know, how do I be a good villageman? Or whatever. And so Dharma is, on one end, it is about enlightenment and ending suffering. But on the other end, it's just also learning about being a good person and seeing how we can better our own lives and those around us, you know. And so when the Buddha would teach lay people, he would teach dana, sila, bhavana. And dana means like generosity and giving, which is close to renunciation in a way, because when you give, like I was very naturally giving this life, and, you know, I would always easily give to in just about all scenarios, you know, and, you know, usually within my means, but you know, if I earned a few hundred dollars, I would give happily spend $100 on food or something for a monastery, and giving for me was never a problem. And the good thing about giving means that when you're helping other people, so like help sick family people, homeless people, people with spiritual traditions who you know don't have money and food and rely on the gifts on others, helping our parents and elderly people in the community. Because when we give, we're making the world a better place. You know, we're renouncing some of our own wealth, some of our own hard-earned money, our own pleasures for the sake of helping others. So it's a very immediate way to make good karma for ourselves. And we're not doing it out of making good karma for ourselves, but that's just a natural result. Because when we reflect on it afterwards, that, you know, you helped in this way. Like there's a couple who comes here and they cook at an Aboriginal kind of centre for homeless people. And they do that a few days a week in their retirement. And so even though it's really hard work for them, I mean, it's a very good thing they're doing. And so it's this idea of going out of our way to do things to help other beings when nobody's asking us to. You know, just doing it just because it's a good thing to do. So that's generosity. And then the Buddha teaches us not only to be generous, but to reflect on that generosity. Because when we reflect on it, then it makes the mind joyful. And then after that, then he teaches sila, which is like in Buddhism, it's called the five moral precepts. And they're like just the things that keep us out of difficulty, like, I have to say them anyway, but like abstention from killing, abstention from stealing, abstention from sexual misconduct, abstention from lying, abstention from drugs and alcohol that lead to heedlessness. And so it's not that you just blindly do these things, but over time you learn. Like it took me some time to give up alcohol. We are in a society that drinks a lot of alcohol. But over time I realized that, you know, I wasn't living to my fullness because you're relying on a substance to relax. And then also it was more difficult to meditate. I was less inclined to be involved with certain activities. But, you know, I would only maybe drink, I'd fall back into drinking for 3 months or something, and it took me a few years to kind of learn that. But that's the idea of learning through cause and effect. So we're not just blindly doing things in Buddhism, but we take things on board and then we see through our own experience if they're true or not. And so lying's obvious. You've seen people who lie a lot and they get in these kind of wet web where eventually it collapses on them. And it's like disastrous. So everybody knows how bad lying can be. And then killing. So in Buddhism, killing is like, I mean, it's humans, number one, so shouldn't kill humans. We all know that. But also then it extends to all living beings. So even insects and animals that, I mean, if rebirth is true, you know, which as Buddhists, you know, through my own experience, I believe it is true, then, you know, well, if I was a moth, I wouldn't want to be squished against the wall. You know, if I was a mouse, I wouldn't want to be chopped in half by a mouse trap. And then, so it's just this idea of, you know, if they're just alive, they don't want to die. And sure, it might take you 5 minutes to catch the moth or catch the mosquito or, you know, a few weeks to catch the mice, but eventually you catch it and drive it down the road and your neighbor can have it. And, you know, so it's like that way we're avoiding killing. And actually, I used to, at the monastery, I used to drive the mice because there's a prison a few kilometers down the road. So I used to drive the mice like halfway between the prison and the monastery so they could choose. And because, yeah, I'm sure they just run back along the road looking for another house again. But, you know, they don't want to die. And, you know, they're not doing that much harm, are they? I mean, what do these insects and animals really do? They're not really causing a problem. And the thing is, to kill a being, that's a kind of a, you know, there's anger there. To kill something, there has to be anger there. You know, so by it being non-violent. And that, interestingly, in Buddhism, I mean, I know I think being vegetarian or vegan is great, but Buddhism doesn't go that far because actually in Buddhism, ultimately, beings are made of elements. So when once a being is being killed, as long as you don't formally ask for that being to be killed, you're not causing any bad karma yourself. So that's why, like, the Buddha would still eat meat. But there's nothing wrong with people being vegetarian. If everybody was vegetarian, then the monks and nuns would be vegetarian because nobody would bring any meat. So, but in that sense, it's like, you know, you can still be a vegetarian and be an angry person. You know, so on that sense, it's like Buddhism is solely focused on the karma of the mind, of the individual. So just to explain, because you get sometimes people getting a bit upset about that. But, you know, we don't encourage, like if we found some meat was killed by that person for us, we can't eat it. So if you went and killed a chicken and then told me, oh, I just killed this for you today, then I couldn't eat that because I'm not allowed to encourage killing. But if you just bought it from a shopping center and it was already dead, then at the end of the day, it's just elements, you know. But the act of killing is bad in Buddhism. You know, so we should never. So if I went to a village and I was relying on that village and they saw I ate meat and then they started, you know, killing for that, then, you know, I obviously in that scenario, you have to tell them, well, you know, you're not going to eat meat because they're killing it. So you have to have that strictness in your practice. And then after killing, sexual misconduct. So that's like if you have a partner, you be true to that partner. And even these precepts, you try and take them through into the mind, you know. So try and be pure in these things in the mind. So it's not just on the surface. That means if you get sick or a difficult scenario in your life, you're still going to have this thing to protect you. Because obviously it's, you know, a disaster when people, you know, they have husbands and wives and things that cheat on them and people get murdered over these things and, you know, it causes lots of difficulty. So this is just, and then if you're choosing to be celibate, like a monk or whatever, that means, that precept means you actually, you know, you're true to that. And so these things on the surface are do not do it. And then on the deeper level, it's at the mind. And then, as I said, the last one is drugs and alcohol. Which is obviously like if you drink some alcohol, it's going to be very hard to meditate afterwards. You're not going to be able to give the greatest help to somebody if you're drunk. And there's the story of this, one of the stories of why the monks can't drink alcohol is because the rules were only given out slowly. And one of the stories was this monk, you know, had these kind of psychic powers. But then after the villagers had given him some rum or something, the Buddha saw him laying there and said, you know, I can't remember what animal, but, you know, now he couldn't even fight like a lizard or something before he could, you know, defeat these great spiritual beings with his psychic power. Meaning, you know, he just had a huge... Because psychic powers do exist in Buddhism. So in the West, we're very kind of materialistic and we don't, you know, many people don't believe that such things exist. But... actually, in Buddhism, this is like the seventh Buddha in a cycle of about 92 universes. And this is like the most materialistic of all those universes. So the reason why everything is so materialistic now is there's very little done. This is the smallest of all the Buddhas. He only had about 1,500 enlightened beings. So at the other end of this, at the beginning of this cycle, they had millions of enlightened beings. So it's like the Dharma slowly falls away, and then it goes in cycles. And then, so in a future universe, you know, there'll be lots of enlightened beings again. So the reason why the understanding of the mind is so little at the moment is because we're very focused on materialism. It's just a bit of a sickness of our current age. But if you look at it truthfully, the mind is forerunner of all things. You know, if you have a good mind, then whatever's happening in the world, that's just happening in the world. You know, you can still choose to do good in your day. The world could be coming to an end and you could be going to feed a homeless person. I mean, why let the external world, you know, destroy your life? So that's the idea that the mind is forerunner to of all things. And then on the higher level, some beings have a ability to develop psychic powers. But in Buddhism, we're not encouraged to develop psychic powers because they can lead you astray. Like, I can read minds and I can astral travel and, you know, it can do this, that and the other. Or develop fire or whatever it is. So they're all kind of bells and whistles. And so the Buddha's basically taught the monks, just get enlightened, you know, make that, you know, end suffering, develop wisdom, and then, you know, if you want to develop these things, it's okay. So that way you don't get sidetracked on the bells and whistles of spiritual stuff. So we'll do a guided meditation now. You just get yourself in a comfortable position. Kind of upright but comfortable. Relax the toes and feet, the ankles, the lower legs, the calves, the shins, up into the knees, the thighs, lower thigh, middle thigh, upper thighs, the hip bones, the waist, the weight of the body onto the seat, the cushion, the floor. It's feeling balanced and at ease. Just become aware of the belly as it rises with the in-breath, falls with the out-breath. Just coming into the present. Don't need to worry about anything. Sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, thought. Let it all go. Just arises and passes away on its own. We can just be with the breath, the rise and fall of the belly. Sometimes it takes a while to slow down. Meditation is a place for peace and calmness, quietness. Rise and fall of the belly. Some people use this as their main meditation object because it's so grounding. Relax the lower back and sides, the middle back and sides, the upper back, the shoulder blades, the tops of the shoulders. Relax the solar plexus and the diaphragm, middle of the torso. Relax the upper torso, the chest, the heart. There's a softness in the heart, relaxing into the present. There's a vitality and ease. Nowhere to go, nothing to do. Okay to be here right now. Just become aware of the lungs, filling up with an in-breath, emptying with the out-breath. We can notice the sensations of the breath. We can see the breath with the mind. It's just the wind element. Lungs filling up and emptying. This process is just grounding and relaxing. Quite often, if we rush to a meditation object, the mind can be restless. Just take the time to settle. Relax the neck and throat. All the muscles, the shoulders again, the upper arms, elbows, lower arms, wrists and hands. Just make the hands in a comfortable position. Straining all tension out into the earth. Relax the neck and throat. Just becoming sensitive to any tension. Relax the jaw, the lips. Might notice this soft smile at the corners of the mouth. Just a smile of relaxing. Relax the teeth, the gums, the tongue down to the root. Around the mouth, the upper cheeks and cheekbones. Around the nostrils, the ridge of the nose, the sides of the nose. Under the eyes. The eyes themselves. Totally relax the eyes. There's so much tension held in the eyes. Relax the temples and the forehead. Sometimes we get these worry lines on the forehead. Just allow them all to vanish. Give up all our problems and complaints. All our concerns. Relax the whole head, the whole body. Any lingering feelings of difficulty in the body, we just bring kindness to them. Accept them as they are. They're not a problem. It's this gentle, patient, kind awareness, accepting the body as it is. The body is relaxed. The eyes are relaxed. And we bring up the mind. Now, the mind has a tendency to flow out into the world of thinking and stories and emotions. We just give up all this flowing out into the world. These asavas, these outflows, give them all up. And there's no judgment in meditation. Whatever happens is good enough. Sometimes we can be restless for 20 minutes and then we just get 2 minutes of peace. There's no judgment, there's no measuring stick. It's just about learning to put the causes in. Don't attach to any particular results. Put down the past. Past is gone. I can't bring it back. No reason to think about the past in meditation. Put down the future. You think 1,000 thoughts and it can still be something else. Now's not the time to plan or think about the future. And just become aware of the mind, the heart, the spiritual experience, whatever you want to call it, as it is right now. And just see if we've got kindness, if we've got patience, if we're being gentle. There's no way to rush, no way we need to go or be. Just have few desires, content to be here right now. Any difficulties or thoughts that arise, you can just gently let them go. Don't have to be concerned by them. Now's the time. If you have a meditation object you like, you can bring it up. I'll give a guided meditation on the breath. This is one, when developed, helps cut out thinking. It's very profound. choose a point of watching the breath, maybe at the lip, at the nostrils, at the heart or at the belly. Maybe follow the flow of the breath. You just choose a means that seems suitable to us, that seems comfortable. Become aware of an in-breath, the sensations, the feelings, and an out-breath, the sensations, the feelings. Meditation can seem difficult, just like somebody learning to study. Begin with it's hard, but over time becomes easy. Aware of an in-breath coming in. Aware of an out-breath going out. Content with just this much. Giving up our aversions and cravings. Aware of the whole of the in-breath, aware of the whole of the out-breath. Bringing peace with the in-breath, bringing peace with the out-breath. Peaceful to be with the in-breath. Peaceful to be with the out-breath. Enjoying the in-breath. Enjoying the out-breath. This is good enough. Like we've come out of a hot desert, we're resting in a cool oasis, undisturbed by any difficulty. It's ease with the in-breath, ease with the out-breath. So brightness and alertness, ease and peace. With the in-breath, with the out-breath. mine has any movement still. You just give up that outflow. Tranquilize the mind. Gladden the mind. Just be with unshakable peace with the in-breath. Unshakable peace with the out-breath. Unshakable peace with the in-breath. Unshakable peace with the out-breath. Unshakable peace with the in-breath. Unshakable peace with the out-breath. Radiant and relaxed. I'll be silent for the next 5 minutes or so. the whole world vanishes. And for a time, we're just with our meditation. You see how the mind is after about 25 minutes of meditation. Is the mind settled down more? Is there more patience, more quietness, more calm? So we learn to see the benefits of meditation. We reflect on the good that it creates, and we're more inclined to build it into our lives. And if people find meditation particularly difficult, you know, always using like a mantra, like Buddha, it's a useful way. I think the mind after meditation is always more calm and relaxed, more at peace, the nerves are calm, even if it's difficult, even if we're new to meditation. We share kindness with ourselves, kindness with those in this room, those on this property, those in this suburb, in Perth, West Australia, Australia, the world, the universe, the ambrosial, all beings. Near or far, we share kindness, and we take this peace with us into our lives. And just remember, meditation is like any skill, so it takes time to develop. Like when you're riding a bicycle, the first time you get on, you usually fall off. But like any skill, it can be developed. Very powerful. All right, so we have a little dedication of merits. If you want to join in, you're welcome to. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nirvana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge and surpasses the protection of the Dharma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
And just a little blessing. Just as the rivers fill the ocean full, even so does that given here benefit the dead and hungry shades. May all your hopes and all your longings come true in no long time. May all your wishes be fulfilled, like the moon, radiant moon on the 15th day, or like a bright and shining gem. May all your misfortunes be avoided. May all your sickness be dispelled. May you never meet with dangers. May you be happy and live long. For those who are respectful and always honor the elders, four are the qualities which increase life, beauty, happiness, and strength. May every blessing come to be. May the devas guide you well. Through the power of the Buddha, may you always be at ease. May every blessing come to be. May the devas guide you well. Through the power of the Dhamma, may you always be at ease. May every blessing come to be. May the devas guide you well. Through the power of the Sangha, may you always be at ease. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And just to know, in Buddhism, so you can always track down monks and nuns and ask them questions. So that's how you learn. Also having your own little groups. So Dharma just means truth. So it's like, because the Buddha was an enlightened being who woke up, so his teachings are like the truth. But then also you need good people in your life. So unless you surround yourself with good people and try and learn to be wise, then, you know, wisdom doesn't come out of ignorance. So so it's like, have to learn these things. Okay, thank you very much.